Atheist Nomads is proudly brought to you by Archway Hosting. Check out their low-price, full-featured hosting solutions at archwayhosting.com. That's A-R-C-H-W-A-Y hosting.com. We are the Atheist Nomads, bringing you history, science, politics, religion, and interviews with leaders in the atheist community. Not all those who wander are lost. Welcome to another episode of Atheist Nomads. This is episode number 51. Joining me as always is Wesley.
51 with a bullet. How you doing?
Doing good. And I, of course, am Dustin.
Oh, yeah.
Wesley, how's life treating you?
Oh, I've got a cough, man. What the fuck?
Oh, damn.
Oh, yeah, tears. But it's a sunny day outside. It's pretty. Let's record the shit so we can get the fuck out.
We've been having kind of shitty weather here.
You got a new puppy.
Yes. Yeah, I did.
I hate small dogs, but it's cute.
Okay, I thought Bucky was too small.
Yeah.
24-pound corgi. But when Lauren posted this to my Facebook page saying he wants us, with the description of how incredibly awesome this dog is, yeah, I was definitely okay with meeting him and then adopting him. It's a 4-pound chihuahua with, he does not have the little dog personality at all. He's just this super chill, laid back dog and looks kind of like the coloring on him, the pattern is like blue heeler.
Yeah, kind of probably weighs about the same as like a porn star's cock.
But. Yeah. So, pretty cool little dog. Yeah. So anyway, on the atheistnomads.com website, I've gone ahead and made a couple new, pages. This is the first time in quite a while that I've made any additions.
Additions.
The first one is how to listen. This is something that I wouldn't have thought until recently would even be needed. But I've been listening to a podcast called The Feed. It is Libsyn's official podcast to help keep podcasters keep going. And one of the things they pointed out is most listeners listen to anywhere from 1 to 3 podcasts, and many don't actually know the best ways to listen. So I wrote up a tutorial. It covers all the different platforms. So Android, iOS devices, Windows Phone, both 7 and 8, and listening from your computer or TV.
Oh.
And so it's got all the stuff you need to know for how to subscribe. And we will be putting out an app at some point here in the future, which will help out those of you who don't have a typical podcatcher on your phone and want to be able to just get us easily. So that'll be coming soon.
I know both of us are Android users. What's your app of choice?
I'm still using Dogcatcher.
I'm a Dogcatcher user also. That costs, if you can find it on sale occasionally for like $3 a pop, but I like that it does audio, video, and text.
Yeah.
All in one.
Lauren just started using Stitcher, which we are listed in.
I've heard good things.
And she's really liking it.
Nice.
And that's a good free option for...
And if you listen on Stitcher or iTunes, be sure to give us a nice rating, if you would, please. Because, yeah, why not?
Actually, I was also looking at the iTunes reviews, and what's kind of annoying is some of the ones that pop up if you're searching by or sorting by most helpful, it's stuff from when we first started.
Right.
So the most helpful ones, the oldest ones, are saying that we're pretty rough and could use some work but have some real potential.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, yeah.
A couple of years too late, but hopefully we're not as rough anymore. Anyways.
Yeah. But yeah, so anyway, there's some additional changes coming up. Some we will announce as we get there, but one that's coming up quite soon is with the feed. The MP3 feed that almost everybody that's subscribed is subscribed through. I'm going to be switching that over to our Libsyn feed. And it will be seamless and transparent to everyone who is subscribed. So don't need to worry there. I will put in the redirect and it will automatically update your subscription.
Basically, all you need to know is Libsyn will keep it so that we will never have downtime.
Yes, it will be in the cloud. And if Archway went down for some reason, say their ISP had an issue.
Which I'm sure never happens.
Every hosting provider has some downtime. Once or twice a year, there will be some.
Sure.
But this way, it's out in the cloud, and we're not abusing their infrastructure.
His generous bandwidth.
Yes.
His generous free bandwidth, which we greatly appreciate.
Not abusing that and insulating it from any potential issues anywhere around the internet. It'll also make it a little bit easier for those of you who aren't in the Northwest to be downloading from an actual closer location. So it might get some better speeds for downloading. Mm-hmm. But one thing that will be coming with that is our premium subscribers. Those are the people that are our patrons and sponsors. They'll be getting a new feed that when I have to cut for time on interviews or news stories, I'll release an extended bit. For the interview, it'll be come out basically as a separate episode with the full interview.
We might still have to make some occasional cuts, but...
Not for time. It might be for content, but not for time.
Yeah. And only on, like, really bad things.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyways.
There's going to be that, and the feed, when it rolls over to Libsyn, it'll have the 10 most recent episodes. That's still, when you think about it, 20 hours worth of content. Now, the other feed will have everything from our entire back catalog. And, of course, if you have an episode you want to listen to specifically, you can just look it up on the website.
Yep.
And finally, with Libsyn, I do look at the stats on there periodically, including where our listeners are coming from, and did want to... let you guys know about this
thing that Edward Snowden has made famous.
Yes. this new software release, Tails, we have talked about it before. We now know that we have listeners in countries where listening to our show could get you thrown in jail. I'm worried about you guys. You aren't all using anonymous proxies. If you're in a country where you can get in trouble for being an atheist, please, please use an anonymous proxy, and Tails makes it really easy.
Awesome little program. Download the ISO file right to your computer. You can actually put it onto a USB drive and boot directly from it. Yep. The site that will be in our show notes gives you instructions on how to do all that. And you could browse the internet on a computer. Just plug in this little thing, restart your computer, and... you're essentially running a copy of Linux that will anonymize your browsing and your surfing.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no reason not to do this.
Yes. It makes it completely anonymous, and it'd probably be advisable to be doing that without the persistent storage, because as long as you don't have any persistent storage there, it will not save any traces of anything you ever did. Completely anonymous and no history. It is, yeah, well worth it. And backtracking a little bit, the other website I made, there's the How to Subscribe to Us. Also made up a page explaining the difference between Patreon and the PayPal subscriptions and easy links and explanations of those and how to sign up. And also with the PayPal one, if you change levels, you need to cancel the one you were subscribed to and create a new one. Otherwise, you're getting double billed.
Which we appreciate.
Yes, yes. Yeah, so anyway, it has all of that explained there. You can check both of those out on our website. We did get a little bit of feedback. Peter was having lunch with Peter Boghossian. And they were... he was sitting with them at lunch and started talking about the podcast. Said, and I quote, "If you'd like to have him, he'd love to be on it. You can reach him at," and gave his email address. Yeah, that's on episode 42.
Yeah, so, yeah. Hey, we appreciate you listening.
Yeah, we might have to have Peter back on the show.
Definitely.
Yeah, we'll definitely have to get him back on. He definitely had some stuff on the works.
Yeah, he's got new projects.
Yeah, and we'll definitely want to hear about where that's going in a few months. So, yeah. The other feedback we got was actually meant for the Scathing Atheist. That was sad.
Yeah, it's all good. All right, next one.
Anyway, you can always contact us at contact@atheistnomads.com or call us and leave us a voicemail at 541-203-0666. And as a little teaser, when the app comes out, you can be able to email or call us with just one click.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. We always want to thank our supporters. And if you are interested in supporting us and haven't yet, especially if you're going to be wanting to get access to premium content, go to that How to Support Us page and sign up.
I will also say that coming soon, swag will be available.
Mm-hmm.
And we will be making that available for purchase and or for our supporters.
Yeah.
So if you got any ideas on promoting that or who we should talk to about getting some stuff, you know, printed up or labeled or whatever, please contact us. All right.
Yes. Oh, and I am drinking some Green Flash Brewing Company Double Stout Black Ale out of San Diego.
Ooh, get a rope. All right. I'm just drinking Rockstar, man. Sugar-free, though.
Ah. Mm. Yeah, Lauren had the most... Well, one of her birthday presents for me was 30 beers for 30 years.
Okay.
So she went and got all of these porters and stouts she could out of the store.
Nice.
Yeah. Yeah.
That actually cost a pretty penny, too.
Yeah. Yeah.
Fuck. 30. Wow. Okay. So, moving on along.
You ready for this day in history?
No. This day in history, May 15, 1756, the Seven Years' War begins. Or as all of us Americans might have known it, the French and Indian War. Yeah, so this turned into like a global conflict before World War One, you know, way back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
So it officially began when England declared war on France. However, fighting and skirmishes, of course, had been going on between them in North America for years before that. Because, well, fuck the French or something. So early 1750s, you know, the French were expanding into the Ohio River Valley, you know, repeatedly. That really brought them into conflict with the British colonies in the same area. 1756 was the first official year of fighting in the Seven Years' War. British suffered many defeats again from the French. I mean, how is that possible? French never win. But, in 1757, the British Prime Minister, William Pitt, the older, recognized the potential for imperial expansion that would come out of the victories against the French and borrowed heavily to fund their war effort. So, you know, hooray for banks. Pitt financed Prussia's struggle against France and her allies in Europe and reimbursed the colonies for raising armies in North America themselves. So, man, poor France. You see how I turned and I was like, ah, bad France. And then I was like, oh, poor France. Yeah, I'll switch on a motherfucker just like that. But by 1760, the French had been expelled from Canada, and by 1763, all of France's allies in Europe had either made a separate peace with Prussia or had been defeated. In addition, Spanish attempts to aid the French in the Americas had failed even. France also suffered defeats against British forces in India. Yeah, so that ended, the whole Seven Years' War ended with the signings of treaties in Hutzertsburg and Paris in 1763. In the Treaty of Paris, France lost all claims to Canada and gave Louisiana to Spain, while Britain received Spanish Florida, Upper Canada, and various French holdings overseas. Treaty ensured the colonial and maritime supremacy of Britain and strengthened the American 13 colonies by removing their European rivals from North and South. Mm-hmm. 15 years later, though, the French bitterness over the loss of their colonial empire contributed to their intervention in the American Revolution on the side of the Patriots. Hooray!
Now, it's also interesting that the whole 7 Years' War helped contribute to the American Revolution happening in the first place. The massive debt that Britain had. They'd sent a lot of that money over to the colonies and thought they needed to get that money back out of the colonies. So they started some pretty repressive taxes, and that prompted the whole...
No taxation without representation.
Yep.
Yeah, the, I mean, but, you know, the whole British kicking the Frenchie's ass really helped stir some animosity, and, you know, that's why the French were willing to help us in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, hooray, kind of. You know, a lot of death and carnage, I'm sure, but, you know, I think if that war hadn't happened, the U.S. would be a really different place right now.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. All right. This day in history, 1800, President John Adams orders the federal government to Washington, D.C. So you may or may not know that pre-1800, the government was actually set up in Philadelphia. But, yeah. So after Congress adjourned its last meeting in Philadelphia on May 15th, Adams told his cabinet to make sure Congress and all federal offices were up and running smoothly 1 month later in their headquarters on June 15th. Philadelphia officially ceased to serve as the nation's capital on June 11th, 1800. But, you know, as many employees as there are of the federal government now, there was only about 125 then. So it wasn't really that hard to shift them all over.
You know? Yeah, and the documents they had to ship around?
I'm sure they didn't fit in mountains at the time.
Yeah, it was so few. Yeah, that was also in the era where Congress met for, what, a few weeks, maybe a month or two?
I'm sure they had actual jobs back then.
Their sessions were actual sessions, not years.
Decades, yeah. interesting side note, though. President and Ms. Adams did not move into the unfinished President's Mansion until November that year. Settling into the White House was a challenge for the First Lady. In December of that year, Abigail Adams wrote to a friend that she had to line dry her clothes in what eventually became the East Room.
So, oh, wow.
Yeah, cute, cute. Oh, boy. This day in history, 1937, Madeleine Albright is born. So, you know, the always really cheery and bouncy Madeleine Albright, America's first female Secretary of State, is born, Maria Jana Korbelova, in Prague, Czechoslovakia. Well, the Czech Republic now. The daughter of a Czech diplomat, Joseph Korbel, you know, Albright fled to England with her family after the Nazis occupied Czechoslovakia in 1939. And although Albright had long believed that they had fled for political reasons, she learned as an adult that her family was Jewish and that three of her grandparents had died in Nazi concentration camps. Fuck. You know, the family returned home after her World War II ended, but immigrated to the U.S. in 1948 after a Soviet-sponsored communist coup seized power in Prague. Joseph Korbel became dean of a school of international relations at the University of Denver, where he had later trained another female Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice. Interesting side note. Yeah, this woman has had a hell of a life and a great education. You know, I've heard people hiding their Jewish roots, but that is crazy. Just to try and escape the Nazis to...
Mm-hmm.
Man, oh man, oh man. But, yeah, this woman was quite the trooper. She was, signed in 1992 with Bill Clinton. And she was so far the most powerful woman in D.C. And I don't think for too much longer. just because of who's going to get elected, I think. So cool. But, and a very colorful character. And this day in history, 1972, Governor George Wallace is shot. You know, this is a very colorful character if you haven't heard of him before. During an outdoor rally in Laurel, Maryland, George Wallace, the governor of Alabama and a presidential candidate, was shot by a 21-year-old Arthur Bremer. Three others were wounded, and Wallace was permanently paralyzed from the waist down. Next day, while fighting for his life in the hospital, he fucking won major primary victories in Michigan and Maryland. However, Wallace remained in the hospital for several months, which pretty much killed his presidential campaign. Whether or not if you've heard of this guy, well, yeah, you should. So I'm going to tell you about this. Wallace was one of the most controversial politicians in American history. He was elected governor of Alabama in 1962 under an ultra-segregationist platform. In 63, in his inaugural address, Wallace promised his white followers, segregation now, segregation tomorrow, segregation for fucking ever. Okay, I put the fucking, but yeah. However, the promise lasted only 6 months, thankfully. Good duck. In June 63, under federal pressure, he was forced to end his blockade of the University of Alabama and allow enrollment of African American students. Despite his failures in slowing the acceleration of civil rights movement in the South, Wallace became a national spokesman for resistance to racial radical change. And in 1964, entered the race for the U.S. presidency. You know, although defeated in most Democratic presidential primaries he entered, his modest success demonstrated to an extent that there really was some popular backlash against integration. In 1968, he made another strong run as a candidate. He actually drew about 10 million votes from across the country. Man, that was just in 68. It's not that long ago. 72, he was back to the Democratic Party for his third and slightly more moderate, but yeah, that's when Bremer shot him. After he recovered, he faded from national prominence and made a poor showing in his fourth and final presidential campaign in 79.
And that was back when the Democrats were where all of the bigots were.
Yeah. During the 1980s, Wallace's politics shifted dramatically, especially in regard to race. He contacted civil rights leaders he had so forcibly opposed in the past and asked their forgiveness. In time, he gained the political support of Alabama's growing African American electorate. And in 83, he was elected Alabama governor for the last time with their overwhelming support. God damn. During the next 4 years, the man who had promised segregation forever made more African American political appointments than any other figure in Alabama history. But, you know, all I'm going to say is that two is greater than one and three is greater than two. So how many are we really talking here? He announced his retirement in 86, telling the Alabama electorate in a tearful address that I've climbed to my last political mountain, but there are still some personal hills I must climb. But for now, I must pass the rope and pick to another climber and say, climb on to higher heights, climb on till you reach the very peak, then look back and wave at me. I too will still be climbing. He died in 1998. Yeah, so maybe people can change.
Yeah, sometimes they can. Sometimes they have to stay viable.
Yeah, sometimes they just need to get smacked the fuck down until they're like, hey, wait, why am I getting smacked down? Oh, wait, yeah, I'm an asshole.
yeah. Alrighty, time for science and technology.
Woohoo!
First off, we've got a British poll, where they found out that 1 in 5 people in that country would have sex with a robot.
Yeah. I'm right there with them.
I would say after the popularity of the Hitachi Magic Wand for women
and men,
the Fleshlight for men, that it wouldn't be much of a stretch to just attach that to a robot so that it can actually control some of what's going on there.
Dude, I have a Hitachi wand. I use it for my shoulder.
Okay. Sure you do. But yeah, they talked to over 2,000 people and asked them about their attitudes towards sex with androids. And
not your phones.
46% said that they felt the technology is progressing too quickly. A third were afraid that robots posed a serious threat to humanity. And the same number, another third, also thought that robots may soon replace key jobs like soldiers, cops, and teachers. But 20% would still fuck a robot.
Man, I wonder if they're going to have, like, robot unions as, you know, sex workers in all those great little northern European countries.
I think we're probably a few hundred years away from technology reaching the point where...
What, for sentience like that?
Robot unionization would be valid?
Nah. We're way closer to sentience, and with sentience would come unionization.
Yeah, perhaps.
You know, robot worker rights and all that stuff, yeah.
However, the robots built for those working would be, they'd make sure they're dumb enough to not have sentience.
Once we get sentience, we're gonna have to like, keep the three laws going, or else, you know, it's going to be some sort of Skynet thing if we don't take care of them nicely.
Or just keep them dumb best we can.
All right, so three laws compatible.
Yeah. DARPA, on the other hand, they'll probably go too far. Not program the three laws because that would cut down on their military applications. And then we got Skynet.
Yep.
It will be a DARPA project, guaranteed. moving along, scientists have finally done something that, well, I think everybody thought wouldn't necessarily ever be able to happen. They have added additional letters to the genetic code of DNA. This is for a strain of E. coli that they were working with. In addition to the G, T, C, and A, they added X and Y. And they added all this extra code to the DNA just to, you know, kind of see if it would work. It's not non-coding DNA at this point. It doesn't serve any actual function. But not only does it is it there, but it gets passed on to the next generation.
Hmm.
Now, here's the really cool thing where this has some amazing potential. The X and Y require access to particular chemicals, and if you remove those chemicals from the diet, they stop coding, and they are deleted from the DNA.
Interesting.
This would be a way to be able to make genetically modified organisms that can do amazing, crazy things with this added DNA, like eat oil or do awesome stuff in labs, like making fuel. And if they get out in the wild or get out of control, they don't have access to that food, and they just revert back to normal bacteria.
Hmm. So that's always one of the nightmare things that people think is going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whatever little GMO thing that we create is going to take over the world, but... You know, you put a little code in there that can, you know, cancel all that shit out, then, hey, pretty cool.
Heck, with enough work on this, now that they've got the proof of concept there, I bet they could make one where they'd have a kill sequence in there that without those chemicals, it just dies.
That's what I'd rather see.
Yeah.
Especially for something like the oil-eating bacteria or mm-hmm. whatever they're having. Yeah.
Keep it fed. It's fine. Yeah, like an oil-eating one. Have it set up so that as long as it has oil to eat, they flourish, but they can't yep. eat anything else.
Yeah.
No more oil, dead bacteria.
Yep, cool with that.
Matthew Becker from Brigham Young University has been looking at tree rings of some drought-sensitive trees in Utah. And in particular, looking at what happens to them in droughts and what is the history of droughts that we've had in the American West. Typically, stream flow records and the like go back anywhere from 10 to 100 years. But yeah, he wanted to get a much better look at it. And what he's found is that over the last 585 years, the longest drought they had was 16 years. The most intense resulted in the Weber River flowing at 13% of normal. That was in 1580. And on three other occasions, it dropped below 20%. The most consecutive worst-case scenarios was the most severe drought, which started in 1492. And four of the five worst droughts all happened within Christopher Columbus's lifetime.
I see it. I see cause and effect right there.
Yeah. But the key thing here, he's looking at it as, looking back at history, what's the worst that can happen? And the drought that the American West is currently dealing with very severe drought conditions in places like California and parts of Oregon and Idaho, these are nothing. it can get a lot worse, and the slightest tweaks to the climate can take dry country and make it, well, absolutely desolate.
I'm just kind of concerned. Is he trying to use this as a anti-climate change guy?
I don't see any evidence of this. It's more just that he's trying to look at what's the historical record. Because if it's happened in the past, there's a decent chance it can happen again. Mm. And trying to see how bad it can get. And also saying that as bad it is as it is now, actually, his own words on it is, we're trying to work with water managers to show the different flavors of droughts this region has had. These are scenarios you need to build into your models to know how to plan for the future. That's not poo-pooing climate change. That's saying, here's the range of things that has happened recently. Let's make sure we're covered. Because what climate change is predicting for the West is more drought. It's going to get drier and drier. And if it's going to get drier and drier, we've got some evidence for how dry it can actually get.
Mm.
Let's be ready.
Yep.
The World Health Organization has come out with a warning that the next big world health crisis is going to be antibiotic resistance. This, of course, is an issue that a lot of people are well aware of, unless you're, say, a member of the followers of Christ cult or the Christian Scientists, where you still have infants dying of things that could easily be treated with penicillin. All those diseases that have been a thing of the past without a lot of great work on creating new antibiotics, we're not going to be able to keep up with the bacteria adapting to us, which means minor injuries can kill people. We'll be able to kill people again, and common infections can wipe out entire populations. This is a call for more research and more funding, and in particular, trying to create cheap antibiotics.
Hmm.
Yeah, that's always good.
Yeah.
Next, we have a Swedish study that was looking at autism. And while they haven't yet pinned down what causes autism, they have found that the risk...
Vaccines.
The risk is half genetic, half environmental. Might sound a little bit like a cop-out, but if you look at the studies that are coming out now, there is seeming to be... some have shown up to 90%... genetic cause. Some show almost all environmental cause. It is looking like it is definitely a mix of the two. And unfortunately, even though we have some pretty solid evidence and consensus forming that at least some of it is genetic, I highly doubt that's going to mean anything to the anti-vaxxers.
Well, come on. When was the last time they actually looked at evidence?
Yeah, if you think about it, somebody who's been discredited as making it all up, saying autism is caused by vaccines, that's a nice, tidy, concise thing. All we have to offer is it's not caused by vaccines, and we have some ideas of where to look, but we don't know what actually causes it. That is not as compelling to a lot of people, especially fear-motivated people.
Well, we've been taking vaccines by the millions for decades and decades. Where was the autism? And I'm sure there was much worse chemicals in those older original vaccines than
actually,
there are now.
That's one of the things with autism is my opinion on that and a lot of other disorders that are out there is that why it seems like a new problem, seems like it's a rising concern, is just better diagnosis.
Yeah, better earlier diagnosis.
50 years ago, a kid not doing well was just special. Now we can say what kind of special.
And autism is such a spectrum of
yeah.
things. Anyways, there's so many things that get lumped into autism. You have a much broader category for it. So you have people that wouldn't have been called autistic in the past are now. And get, like you said, better diagnoses and much earlier diagnoses, which mm-hmm. you know, you wouldn't usually notice this stuff until, you know, two-ish or three-ish sometimes, but... Man, it just happens that they start getting their first round of shots about the same damn time.
Yeah.
That they're able to finally diagnose this stuff.
Heck, 40 years ago, people probably wouldn't have diagnosed there was even a problem until school started.
Mm.
It's this is one of those where, yeah, now that we know what's going on, it seems a lot worse. But no, this stuff, it's always been there.
And knowing is half the battle.
But one thing with this is until science can come up with pretty definitive what causes autism, I think we're going to have a hard time making any headway with the anti-vaxxers that claim autism. And that is aggravating. But we are now to politics and religion. The U.S. Supreme Court has started releasing their rulings from their March session, including a very disappointing one where they ruled that the town of Greece, New York, is just fine having sectarian prayers, and that they didn't violate the Constitution when they picked the prayer givers who were overwhelmingly Christian.
Interesting side note on that. You might have heard about the guy down in Florida that won the right to put up his Festivus pole up in the that was made up of PBR beer cans. That same guy now came out as a Satanist and wants to have his Satanist prayers at some of their meetings down in Florida.
Awesome.
So he's trying to make that happen.
With this case, and we've got several articles linked here in the show notes. It really comes down to, as long as you don't try to proselytize, and that anyone, any clergy, they were specific enough with that, at least any clergy can give prayers, whether they are Christian or not, there is no problem with them being sectarian. So Christians can pray in Jesus' name, as long as they don't say that, and all the Hindus and Muslims and atheists here are going to burn in hell. And Pastafarians can ask for the flying spaghetti monster to send his noodly appendages to touch the council members
in all their special places.
And the Satanic Temple has issued a recommended satanic invocation. And actually, if you look at Hemant Mehta's piece on that on Friendly Atheists, he's willing to give $10 to anybody that actually does it. I'm tempted. And I'm an ordained minister by the Universal Life Church Monastery.
Oh, boy.
All right. That's a disappointing one. If you look at one of the opinions that was included with it, this was not the official majority opinion, but Clarence Thomas's concurring opinion, he thinks that the First Amendment probably just prohibits Congress from establishing a national religion.
Has he even read it?
He's looking at the history of the time. And, you know, at least six states in 1789 had established churches. Yeah. And quoting from him, the import of this history is that the relationship between church and state in the fledgling republic was far from settled at the time of ratification. No shit, it was far from settled. Those churches were left over from the colonial era, and yeah, it may have taken them 30 years to make them no longer official state church, but by 1820, there were no more official state churches. And if there had ever been a case where adding one would have made sense, it would have been Utah.
Hmm.
And nobody even viewed that as a possibility. Yeah, things weren't perfect in the colonial era. Heck, women, minorities, and non-landholders couldn't vote at the time that the Constitution was ratified. Do we want to go back to that now?
Yeah. Sure, why not? Makes it simpler, right? Just let the old white men vote?
Old white land-owning men vote.
Yeah, sorry, rich white old men.
Yeah. Yeah, do we want to have polling places check your ID and your title? Your deed?
Well, actually, I would be allowed under that rule. Fuck it.
Yeah.
All right. That works. Fuck all y'all. I'm voting.
Yeah. Oh, anyway, moving along, in Texas, there was a high school student who has been protesting the government by refusing to stand for the Pledge of Allegiance. He told KHOU News that, "I'm really tired of our government taking advantage of us." And he has been, you know, for that, he has been refusing to stand. Then a different teacher was in his classroom when that when he, again, did not stand for the Pledge of Allegiance. And the teacher said, "This is my classroom. This is the principal's request. You are going to stand." And he still didn't stand, so she gave him a write-up, which then went to the principal, who gave him 2 days of in-school suspension. And that in-school suspension is going to continue with 2 days for every day he doesn't stand for the pledge. Now, of course, okay. This goes against the 1943 Supreme Court ruling, West Virginia State Board of Education versus Barnett, which says that people cannot be compelled to stand and observe the pledge. From the majority ruling in that case, if there is any fixed star in our constitutional constellation, it's that no official, high or petty, can prescribe what shall be orthodox in politics, nationalism, religion, or other matters of opinion, or force citizens to confess by word or act their faith therein. As I recall, much of the early rulings on that were dealing with Jehovah's Witnesses who refused to pledge allegiance to anything but Jehovah.
Okay.
And so they can't stand for the Pledge of Allegiance because of religious reasons. There are atheists who refuse to stand because of the under God in the pledge.
Which this kid has not said that he is or he isn't or whatever. Who cares? But
he's just refusing to stand because he thinks the government is taking advantage of us.
Which may or may not be true. He might be completely misguided, but who gives a fuck? You know? And he's getting stuffed into a little room, I'm assuming, going by my record, my recollection of being in in-school suspension fairly often. you're in a little room. You all you do is either study or read, can't sleep. So he may or may not be getting his assignments in there. I'm guessing he is, but he's definitely not getting help for any questions he has on these assignments. So all this administrator is doing is fucking this kid's education. So
he's a fucking high school sophomore, and this teacher flipped out because he won't stand up.
Well, this is one nation under God, after all.
Now, one thing that's even more aggravating with this is this refusing to stand is for the moment of silence, the Pledge of Allegiance, and the Texas Pledge. Texas has their own, and yeah, if somebody asked me to stand for a moment of silence, I wouldn't do it. It's a fucking waste of time. This is a classroom. God fucking damn.
You gonna give all the handicapped kids detention too because they can't stand up?
Oh.
Gotta be fair.
All right.
You're in a wheelchair? Fuck it. You better stand up, Timmy, or you going to in-school suspension too.
Okay. All right. Moving over to Florida. Levee County, Florida has now twice rejected the application of the Williston Atheists to put up an atheist monument next to their Ten Commandments monument.
Hmm.
Initially, it was that their application just wasn't complete. Now the reason, and I quote from their report on the project, "None of the texts on the proposed monument appear to be a reproduction of the entire text of any document or person as required in the county guidelines." Now, quoting from Charles Ray Sparrow of the Williston Atheists, "It's just an excuse. Ten Commandments Monument didn't display the entire Bible or even the Old Testament or the Book of Exodus. We will not give up."
Good.
This monument has quotes from Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin, Madeline Murray O'Hare, and the issue is that they're just putting up quotes, not quotes. Sounds like they're just quoting from the wrong book.
Ooh. Okay, well, I always liked Epicurus. You know, his quotes are older than the Bible's.
Yeah. So if this continues getting rejected, heck, if they don't reverse this rejection on those grounds, this will be in court real soon. And I think a judge, even the most conservative Christian judge, will have a hard time supporting that. And now, still in the South. This is three stories now coming from the American South. In North Carolina, and this is actually a nice, happy, heartwarming story, a group of clergy Typically, you think clergy in the South, and you start getting a sick feeling in your stomach. No, this time, they have filed a federal challenge to North Carolina's Amendment 1, which is their constitutional ban on same-sex marriages, claiming that it violates their freedom of religion. From one of the plaintiffs in the case, Reverend Joe Hoffman, a senior minister from the United Church of Christ. As senior minister, I'm often asked to perform marriage ceremonies for same-sex couples in my congregation. My denomination, the United Church of Christ, authorizes me to perform these ceremonies, but Amendment 1 denies me my religious freedom by prohibiting me from exercising this right. Out of 66 marriage equality suits filed around the country, this is the first one citing First Amendment freedom of religion. All right, now moving to Saudi Arabia. Which, by all accounts, could be considered the south of the world. Sorry, Australia.
All right, that was cute.
Raif Badawi, a prominent Saudi activist, had a 2013 conviction for 7 years in prison and 600 lashes for insulting Islam and violating the kingdom's anti-cybercrime laws. Had that conviction overturned by an appeals court. And they then sent it back for a retrial. The new trial has come down with a sentence of 10 years in prison and 1,000 lashes.
And his attorney is now in jail as well.
Mm-hmm.
His attorney ended up in jail before this sentence got handed down. And so he ended up having to represent himself for quite a while in this case.
Yeah, the attorney was charged with undermining the image of the kingdom and breaking allegiance with the king.
Fuck.
Sounds like a case of he got put on trial for taking the case.
Pretty much.
For taking his brother-in-law's case.
Well, see, that's his mistake. I mean, family's always going to fuck you.
Oh, man.
Take advantage of you.
Yeah, but with this trial, it all started because he started a website and forum where users could freely discuss religion. And as soon as people can freely discuss religion, all of a sudden Saudi Arabia's ultra-conservative form of official Islam can get criticized.
Ooh, horrible, horrible.
Yeah. As far as we know, good Muslims were criticizing their form of Islam, let alone, oh no, maybe one of them were an atheist. And now moving to the UN, their anti-torture group has now taken their turn grilling the Vatican over their handling of the raping of children by their church.
Ooh.
By and large, this is all, you know, pretty standard stuff and kind of old, but there's some lines from the Holy See's UN envoy, Monsignor Silviano Tomasi.
Very well.
Who said, "It should be stressed, particularly in high of much confusion, that the Holy See has no jurisdiction over every member of the Catholic Church. The Holy See wishes to reiterate that the persons who live in a particular country are under the jurisdiction of the legitimate authorities of that country and are thus subject to the domestic law and the consequences contained therein. State authorities are obligated to protect and, when necessary, prosecute persons under their jurisdiction, which would all be fine and good if the Catholic Church was turning over people they knew to be child molesters and not shuffling them out of the fucking country and cloistering them in the Vatican City." Oh, that last part was from me, not from the Monsignor.
Oh, right. Okay, so if they're subject to the domestic law of wherever they're living, I'm betting that almost all of those places have laws that say that you're not allowed to, you know, cover for a people that kill or abuse or torture or anything like that. So
most of those places have exemptions for the confessional.
Yeah.
Petitioned and lobbied by the fucking Catholic Church to make sure that they don't have to rat out somebody who's confessing of their sins. Well, if you're a priest, the only person you can confess to is your bishop. So you go to your boss and say, "Father, I have sinned. I have fucked another boy. and the bishop can't tell anyone under Vatican law and isn't required to under state law in many, many states. So what can he do? Shuffle him off to someplace else.
The bishop just asks, what? It's not Wednesday. You're supposed to wait for us.
Yeah. Yeah. The convention that was grilling them, their whole purpose is to ensure that parties take measures to prevent the commission of violations. They want to make sure there is no safe haven. And if anybody has ever provided safe haven, it's the Catholic Church. And now to Nigeria. Unless you've been in a cave, you would know by now that Boko Haram has abducted somewhere in the ballpark of 300 girls, mostly aged about 16 to 18, who are attending Western-style schools, which they think no women should be getting educations, and especially should not be getting a Western-style education. And they are going to be, or at least have threatened to sell them as slaves, which means as sex slaves, which under Islamic law is just fine.
As long as they're not Islamic, or...
Even if they are Islamic.
Well, as long as they haven't broken any rules, really. I thought they weren't supposed to sell good Islamic people into slavery.
That could be possible. But, yeah, this is fucking nuts. We're talking about at least 276 girls getting kidnapped and sold into slavery for going to school. Their only crime was trying to get an education.
What does Boko Haram mean? It's like no Western education or no Western something?
I don't know what it actually means, and I'm too lazy to look it up. They're a rebel group within Nigeria. They're a Islamicist terrorist group. But man, this is... I'm having a hard time coming up with the right words about how wrong this is, because it's so fucking obvious that this is wrong.
I'm kind of nodding. For people that can't see this, I'm nodding my head and kind of like, yeah, it's a no shit sort of thing.
Yeah. They just want an education. When is... Well, one thing that the world could really benefit from right now would be... And yes, as great as the destruction of all religion would be, that's not going to happen. But Islam could really use a reformation.
Oh, yeah.
Christianity had a reformation that caused both the reformed groups and the non-reformed groups to take a look at what they were doing and make sure they fit with the post-Renaissance era. It made it so that Christianity could survive through the Enlightenment. And in some cases, Christianity even has a chance now of surviving through the modern era. Islam hasn't had anything like that. And they really need something to make sure that Muslims all come to a place where they can actually fit in the modern world. Because stuff like kidnapping girls for trying to get an education and things like slavery, that shouldn't have made it out of the 19th century. God fucking damn.
Oh, and, Boko Haram kind of means something like, Western culture is Islamically forbidden.
Okay. All right, so, an Israeli archaeologist, Eli Shukron, has claimed that he has found King David's Citadel.
Yay!
He is one of many archaeologists who have claimed to have found King David's Citadel.
This doesn't sound like it's going to end well.
This is a $10 million excavation in an Arab neighborhood in Jerusalem, and it was financed by an organization that settles Jews in guarded homes in Arab areas of East Jerusalem. Sounds suspicious.
You got a Jew that's digging up all the Palestinian areas.
Yeah.
All right.
This whole concept of biblical archaeology. There's two ways that it... Actually, there's really one path it takes. It starts out with nutbags thinking they can prove the Bible, or in this case, the Talmud, with archaeology. So they say, oh, that looks like King David's Citadel, or that looks like Heshbon, or that looks like some other place mentioned in the Bible. And they start digging to prove that this was the place that the guy thinks it was, and then claim, yes, this was it. And if they do that, then they kind of die out because, well, that's bullshit.
They start with a premise and work backwards.
Yeah. Then you have the ones like the archaeological project I was a part of that started as a guy going, I will find the biblical city of Heshbon and prove that it exists, and found a spot that he thought seemed as good as any, and he started digging.
Yeah.
And, okay, it was a cool site, but probably not Heshbon. So had somebody else start another project nearby, and another project nearby, and, okay, yeah, there's no evidence that any of them were the biblical city of Heshbon.
I'm going to bet that, you know, all these places that this Israeli guy is digging up that belong to all these Palestinians, once they fill this all this dirt back in, Palestinians and Arabs are not moving back in there.
Yeah.
That they will just be new Israeli tracts of houses.
Yeah. But yeah, so anyway, in some cases, biblical archaeology can take a turn towards being legitimate, where the project that started for religious reasons is now just archaeology. It kind of stops being biblical archaeology and just becomes archaeology. Even if they're still publishing it in the Biblical Archaeology Review, well, that's just because it's in the place where the Bible took place.
And that's probably who's paying for the dig anyways.
Actually, I don't think that journal pays for them, but at least gives them the publicity to help keep money coming in. But it's the right way to do archaeology is one of those where sometimes it's a science and sometimes it's a pseudoscience. And when it's a science, it's where you're going and you're wanting to see what's there and you're basing your conclusions upon the evidence you find. And when it's a pseudoscience, is like this guy did, and you go to a place with conclusions about what's there, and then you try to find evidence to back up your conclusions. And when it's like that, it's bullshit. And Eli Shukran, he may be digging and he may be doing archaeology, but all he's digging up is bullshit.
Bullshit. Ah, good one.
And the Satanic Temple. Oh, they're back in the news again. They've been getting a lot of really good press.
They're coming up some really good ones, though.
Man, this latest one,
they deserve it.
The Harvard Extension Cultural Studies Club has been planning reenactments of various religious services, including a black mass, a Shinto tea ceremony, a shaker exhibition, and a Buddhist presentation on meditation. These are going to be educational activities and a student-led series looking at various different cultural groups and belief systems. Well, the Archdiocese of Boston won't have it. They have warned that this not only violates Catholic teachings, but it could open the door for dark forces.
Ooh.
Oh. Well, of course, this gave Lucian Greaves, the spokesman for the Satanic Temple, a chance to weigh in on it. And quoting from him, from what he told the Raw Story, the Black Mass has not always been, quote, a parody of Catholic Mass, end quote. As they claim, the idea of the Black Mass began as a propagandistic literary device to justify brutal purges against witches. This conspiracy of witches or Satanists has never actually existed. The idea of the Black Mass surely originated within the church itself. The church's response to that is that, you know, they reject anything that's an attack on the Eucharist. Greaves continues with that the Black Mass was a symbolic revolt against arbitrary authority, not a focused assault on Catholic faith. The Black Mass has no supernatural implications for us. It's simply a declaration of personal independence for the participants. As such, we have no need for a consecrated host, and we don't subscribe to the infallible notion, or excuse me, the infantile notion of magical bread. I have no problem with offending superstitious sensibilities, but I do regret the fact that we seem to have given the Boston Archdiocese, still apparently groping for a sense of purpose and identity after their pedophilia scandal, a temporary diversion on which they can focus their holy indignation.
Yeah, because, you know, eating flesh and drinking blood is not creepy in the least.
Mm-mm.
Like the Catholics do every Sunday. Yeah.
They're standing up for individualism. They're standing up against dogma. Yeah, they do it in an interesting way. They pick as their mascot the guy who, okay, realistically, if you read the Bible, really actually comes across as the good guy. You know, Satan.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
The one that questions all the dickish things that God is doing.
Heck, if you look at the version of Satan in Adventism, he was the angel, the archangel in heaven, who challenged God for being a dictator and then gave people the knowledge of good and evil. Yeah, he should be worshipped as a literary hero.
Yeah.
Personally, I think Satanism takes it a little far, taking a literary hero and making a mock religion out of it.
Ah, come on, fuck it. They're all atheists that just like LARPing.
But, oh man, I am so glad that the Satanic Temple is there. Because every time some crazy bishop cries foul about something, they can stand up and say, oh, wait a minute, that's not really what we're doing. And every time somebody tries to put up a... Oh, heck, look at the with the prayers... The prayers in front of councils, some of the responses that have come from that is, oh, it's going to be just Christian only because if we start opening the door to everybody, what's going to happen? Yeah, I fucking want satanic invocations.
I want them all.
Every place there is a Ten Commandments statue on government land, I want a satanic monument right next to it. Because until they realize the door to their worst nightmare is being opened by their bringing religion into our government, they're not going to shut that door.
And I want every fucker to know that wherever there's a Ten Commandments statue on government property, already right next to it, there's an invisible pink unicorn statue right next to it. It's there. Just
prove
saying.
There isn't.
Goddamn right.
And on that note, I think it's time to move on to the interview. Joining us now is Miranda Celeste Hale. She is a writer, rhetoric and composition instructor, author, public speaker, researcher, and all-around skeptic and atheist. Her work within the skeptic community, including presentations at TAM 2012 and 2013, have primarily focused on the intersection of rhetoric and skeptical activism. She has also written, discussed, and spoken a great deal about the serious consequences and lifelong negative after effects of Catholic childhood religious indoctrination. Miranda, welcome to Atheist Nomads.
Hi, thanks, guys. And
hello.
I wrote that bio like months ago, and I had, I think that's the one, and I had, I think, 10 minutes to write it, and I was like, oh, God. It was for the, I think it was for the Dawkins Foundation videos, and, I was like, bios are weird, mm-hmm. In the third person especially, but that's life.
Oh, yeah, they definitely are.
It feels really weird. I don't know.
Like, so how are you doing today?
I'm not bad. A little frazzled, but it's finals week, or after finals week, so I'm grading, but which is not fun, but you know, everything's okay.
Well, definitely yeah. Appreciate you taking a little bit of time out to talk to us.
Absolutely.
From all that grading.
Oh yeah, well, this is a lot more fun, and I'm a procrastinator anyway, so I
don't the care. Interview's just started, just wait, might not be, just wait.
Oh. Oh yeah.
Let's start off with you know, how did this all get started? What was your life like growing up in the Catholic Church?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't remember a time when I didn't know I was Catholic. And because it was, well, even before school, it was home and church constantly. And, especially with my I spent a lot of time with my grandparents who were hardcore Catholics. I was telling people recently, you know, in an amusing way, when John Paul just got canonized, that when I grew up, I thought John Paul was a member of my family because my grandparents had his picture everywhere in their house. Because they had gone to Vancouver, BC to see him, I believe, when I was a kid, sometime in the 80s. And so they had this calendar, they got there, and everywhere these pictures. So I just remember being immersed in Catholicism and the church and going to church, you know, just as one does. But it was mostly just, I never remember not feeling afraid of sin and being a sinner and afraid of going to hell. And it's just, to me, it feels just so sad and depressing and just upsetting that that's not obviously not just my experience, but that any child would be afraid of going to a literal hell when they're 4 years old, you know, and constantly then avoiding sin and just being afraid of it and fearing that you will, even the slightest transgressions will result in burning in hellfire. And as a kid, you picture, you know, a pretty bad hell, but also it's cartoonish and scary and, you know, so, I mean, I'm not to make light of it, but it's, so it becomes, I think, an obsession to avoid sin. And it's just so sad for any child to have that experience, I think, and to then spend so much time avoiding it. It's just such a waste of time. And then, once I went to school, then it was Catholic school. So there was another, way, you know, so I never really had any time away from Catholicism ever. Mm-hmm. It was just constantly there. And it made me very afraid, I think, a very nervous child, just constantly afraid of messing up or transgressions. So once I started questioning it, I was in high school, a Jesuit high school.
And were your parents really strict?
I didn't really know my father growing up because he was just this kind of deadbeat guy who was a drug dealer and was in the mafia, actually. It's seriously.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I know. His friend ended up in a trunk, dead. He's just a weird dude. He lives somewhere in Washington still, apparently, because he still owes my mom $26,000 in back child support. So she'll get like $37 checks that they take from. He's got some legit job apparently now, not just playing poker. Anyway, so I grew up with my mom, a single mom. You know, she did her best. She's a really good person. But yeah, she was pretty intense. My grandparents were especially intense. I spent a lot of time with them. So yeah, there was that. There was the fear of punishment. Both from, at home and from just then from school also too. I also grew up a creationist, which, was pretty common for I don't know if the hardcore Catholics or what you call it. I think it was fairly mainstream Catholics, but, because, you know, John Paul, until John Paul said in the 90s that, you know, you could sort of believe in evolution as long as you, acknowledge the fact that at some point God dropped the souls into the heads of people, that it was not just, you know, evolution by natural selection. So then it was a little bit okay. And by that time I was a senior in high school, I think, or sometime somewhere in high school. So, it happened between my time in biology class and then in zoology. And then, so I was in the creationist biology, which was honors biology, which is so sad that we were creationists in the honors biology. And then ended up in zoology I don't know how you're supposed to say that, but, and then we could sort of believe in evolution, my senior year. So it's just kind of sad, you know, there's that aspect of it too. So yeah, being afraid to question even, that's, I think, the biggest problem, if we want to quantify it, that if questioning is a sin, then we will never, you know, that is what keeps people, the hold on people, you know, so you're afraid mm-hmm. to even question. Then that's, if you never question, you're never going to, if you feel guilty for questioning, you know, there's probably a lot of people that never proceed with their questioning because I remember it being scary, you know, you going to face a lot of punishment and consequences for that, unfortunately. Well,
that's essentially the biggest problem out there is if you question, you're going to hell.
Yeah, exactly. Because
you're going to start wondering, like, how does the Holy Spirit fit into this? And that's the Trinity. I mean, the Spirit, that's the hardest thing to believe in. That's
exactly.
God's up there. Jesus, was down here for a while, but the Holy Spirit, we're like, how does that work? And you start doubting. You're like, oh my God, I'm going to hell.
You sound like I just thought of fucking magnets. How do they work? Which Jake Farwart and I did a dramatic reading of on his podcast recently, which was hilarious.
Nice.
Out of that song. He got all the good lines, unfortunately, because we were switching off. But yeah, once you start to question, then everything will eventually fall apart if you proceed in your questioning, mm-hmm. obviously, especially if you're enough of a critical thinker. So there's that process of not wanting you to be a critical thinker.
Hopefully everything falls apart.
Yeah, exactly.
You're going to blow a blood vessel or something.
And yeah, it's like, and I think that was part of my problem in high school was that, the Jesuits provide a really good education other than the compulsory religious part of it. But you spend all your time, you spend all your time going to really intense, good, informative, useful classes that provide, a classical, well-rounded, great education. But then 1 hour, 2 hours a day, you're in your whatever current religious classes and you're supposed to turn your mind off, when you go in there, essentially. So you're in physics and you're in history, AP English, French, whatever. Then you go into like a scripture or church doctrine class and you got to turn your mind off. So that was, I think, the cognitive dissonance there was what eventually, I think, started my process of, I didn't know what the word atheist, I don't think I knew the word atheist, but I just knew that I no longer could believe in without evidence. And mm-hmm. then, and I just was, wanted to, I just couldn't be a Catholic anymore. And
so were you ever, did you ever go through confirmation?
Oh yeah, absolutely. So I did everything that one does essentially up through age 16 and then still had to go to church till I was 18 and left home for college. But, absolutely. I did communion confirmation at 14 or 8th grade or whenever we did it. And I became fervently religious for a while, but right before I became an atheist, and I think it was probably in retrospect to try to squash my doubts. Mm-hmm. So I decided I wanted to be a nun when I was like 14 or 15, which is so, in retrospect, it was amusing as hell. And then, I was a very religious kid. There's an element of scrupulosity to it too, which I think is something that leads to that Catholic guilt issue that's almost a cliche, but is true, that we constantly spend our time avoiding, obsessively avoiding sin. And then there's the cliche, but again, also true of the rosary beads. So you spend your time, kind of
massaging them
in church and stuff is like this comfort thing. So I remember doing all of those things and then just thinking, well, okay, if I become a nun, then I will be sent to heaven automatically or, be less likely to sin. My grandma was constantly obsessively worrying about the fact that none of her 8 children or her grandchildren was going to be a priest or a nun. So, which is just like a weird thing to worry about.
She's
dead now, so I never let on to her that I'd become an atheist. It was a little easy because she, died only a few years after, but, so I was definitely very religious, went through all the confirmation and everything, but I didn't have a choice for confirmation. They make it so it sounds like this big, awesome choice. You're choosing as an adult to be in the church. But if I would never have had a choice not to do it. And I was only 13, I think. And the sad thing is, I think some Catholic kids do it, or children of Catholic parents, I should say, do it when they're 8 years old. So
yeah, seven or eight is mm-hmm. earliest.
Yeah, because that's like that's communion age to me, but apparently first communion age, but apparently they get confirmation, some of them. And I don't understand the logic of that at all because you're not an adult. And so, I had no choice but to be confirmed. So it, technically, I'm, you know, I guess, God, what is the word? I get the two words confused, but I guess I'm an apostate. Is that the word? Or there's two words. There's heretic and apostate, and I used to know which one.
Apostate, somebody who walks away from it. A heretic, somebody who has the wrong interpretation.
Yeah, right. So I guess, yeah, technically I'm apostate, which is great. I got called a known enemy of the Catholic Church once by this.
Oh, nice.
I know, on the internet by this guy who runs, this old angry British Catholic guy who runs the Catholic Herald in the UK, because I had written this thing that online that he thought was, you know, horrifying.
Ask him to make you a certificate.
I know, I want a t-shirt, actually. I really should have done that. But because someone said, have you read, in the comments to this thing he had written, have you read this thing that I had written? And he's like, she's a known atheist, a known enemy of the Catholic Church. He's basically the Bill Donahue of Britain. I can't remember his name. Yeah, he's some just
God old Catholic. Bless him.
Oh, I know. Yeah, so he's a, I have always joked about having that on a shirt, because it'd be awesome, but
yeah,
so a known enemy. So yeah, just I think there's, I guess the thing is, there's the Catholic guilt thing is I have no problem joking about it, but I think it is a real thing though too. And I don't think it's just Catholicism, obviously, but that's what I know, so I tend to focus on it. I think there's a part of childhood religious indoctrination that stays with us, the after effects of it, no matter what we do, because I think it's not, we can't reach it by logic or reason or rationality. It can't, you know, there are ways to not let it affect us, but I think it's almost like in a part of our brain, not literally, but that we can't, we can't change it. We can't get to it. We can't, no matter how smart we get or our critical thinking skills.
Mm-hmm. That shit's buried deep.
And
from what I can tell, only Jews do that whole guilt thing better than Catholics.
Yeah, exactly.
One thing I think Catholics do really well with it is they offer the solution to it with something you can physically do. So you just start building this constant reinforcement of your guilt and having to go to the church to get rid of it, as opposed to the more Protestant just praying for forgiveness.
That's true. Yeah, confession is a weird, weird thing. That's another sacrament, you know, that would go into first reconciliation, I guess, is the, yeah, you do that. Well, we did it right before confirmation. But I remember having to make up sins to tell the priest, because when you're a kid, you know, I mean, like, maybe you know, did something bad, quote unquote. But I remember, you know, I mean, so then there's like a double sin, because you were kind of lied to them. So then you're, you know, so it's just it's a weird experience. You know, you're telling your sins to the priest. Usually you're sitting with the priest. And
did the priest ever say, I'm sure you did something worse than that? Is that why you lied?
I don't remember. For me, no, because it was, I was just a little girl, you know, so I don't know, you know, I'm sure the people that, you know, that the priest would probably suspected of more hijinks have different experience than me. But, I think I last went to confession in ninth grade or something, but, but it's the traditional thing. I never was in one of those confessionals where like it's like dark and there's like a partition like in the movies where people go and confess their murders or whatever. That's it's an interesting thing. You get, you know, as long as you do your penance, you get absolved, and you still, obviously you're still a sinner and you still have your guilt, but then you could feel better. But then, yeah, it's a vicious cycle. Because then you sin again and you no longer feel relieved. So you have to go and sort of get the priest to tell you that, do your penance. And it's, you know, so I don't think it's, you know, it's not to say that the after effects or the guilt make people necessarily have like mental health issues or anything, although I'm sure it can. But it is an emotional thing that I think a lot of us deal with and just try to figure out how to, you know, once I became an atheist, I've been an atheist. I've never questioned that or felt the need. I've never really been like, wow, should I believe in God again? And I've never considered going back to Catholicism, yet it still stays with me, I think, to a certain extent. And I still, feel the, you know, after effects of it. And I think sometimes I feel the guilt of it. It doesn't stop me from doing things, but I don't consciously feel it, but it's definitely harder to extract yourself from than God to me, because my questioning of God and my becoming an atheist was a question of the evidence of there's no evidence for God. So, you know, it's basically, to me, God is a scientific question, essentially, mm-hmm. you know, like the Dawkins scale.
Well, I tell you what, then I say that you should do 50 kneel, sit, stands yeah. as your penance.
Yeah, exactly. Get some workout in there. Yeah, doing the prayers.
No dancing.
It could be creative. I don't know how the priests, I don't think the priests have like a book of what to tell you to do. I don't know if they make it up, but it's kind of interesting. just do 15 Hail Marys, whatever. I think it really does affect people and to different degrees. Some people grow up, they have fond memories of growing up sort of casually Catholic, I think. And then leaving it. But I don't think there's a lot of casual Catholics as compared to how many people are like casual Anglicans or, you know, mm-hmm. things like that where they're culturally religious. Or I don't know. So those of us, as you guys can, I'm sure, relate, who, you know, just have the past experiences of being in like non-casual religions, let's say, have different experiences, and it's going to stick with us to a certain extent more than others. And to me, it's just, I worry about, you know, the childhood religious indoctrination. It's the one thing that I suppose makes me the most upset or frustrated about it. It's the whole thing, you know, the Jesuit thing is, give us the motto, give us the boy until age seven, and we will give you the man, which is true in a way. It's just it doesn't work on some of us, thankfully, but
it might not stick, but like you were saying earlier, that indoctrination, that little bit of psychology just stays in the back of your head.
That's true. Exactly. So it does succeed in a way, which is depressing, but true. So it's sad. It does stick with you for your whole life, I think, to a certain extent. They are proud of it, and I understand it's, you know, it's how they keep the church full of people, you know, because you grow up Catholic, generally you don't leave the church. It's almost like it's a genetic thing.
Cases it really is.
Yeah.
You know, look at Ireland, for example.
Oh, yeah, for sure. That would be
the prods and tags.
Exactly. That would be interesting, but a whole different thing where it's almost like your ethnicity, well, you know, tied into it. Absolutely.
That whole old Christopher Hitchens joke, you know, he's going through a checkpoint. They ask him if he's they ask him if he's a Catholic or Protestant, he says he's an atheist, and they ask him, is he a Catholic atheist or Protestant atheist? Fuck.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Is that in Hitch 22, or I can't remember?
I think he's just telling a joke from
I remember it's from something, yeah. That's funny. Catholicism is a bitch.
All right, so you got out of the Catholic Church, and how did you get started with skeptical activism?
Absolutely. I didn't know what atheism meant. I certainly didn't know what skepticism was for quite a while. I knew the word atheism, I imagine. But when I went to college, at the University of Washington, I started to read. I read Darwin and different, you know, Dawkins and a few different books. Nothing to do with atheism. I think I just realized, you know, that I had no knowledge of biology, which is embarrassing when you are, especially when you are otherwise an educated person and you have no clue about biology because, you know, grew up with creationism. So I kind of, taught myself that, got into that. I knew I was an atheist. I was briefly an angry atheist, I would say, when I was probably 17 or 18. I wanted to, like, burn the Bibles and all that shit. But, eventually, I don't think it was until, you know, I was in grad school or whenever that the whole new atheist thing became prominent, that I started, you know, to read those things or to have any experiences online with atheism, sort of like the Four Horsemen books came out and all that. I became more familiar with that, read those books, started to eventually write about atheism and Catholicism online. The Catholic stuff was what, you know, what got a lot of attention, because I think people love a story in a sense. And also I understandably people are fascinated by the indoctrination aspect of it, I think, and people's experiences with that. So I got into atheism that way. I think there's a glut of, this was, you know, a few years ago, obviously it's a little different now, but I don't know, better or worse. There's a glut of atheist people online doing atheist stuff that don't have a unique take on it. So writing about atheism and things like that, to me just wasn't, I don't think I had anything necessarily useful to or unique to say about atheism. So, Catholicism sort of became my thing, and writing about that, obviously it's tied to atheism. So the ex-Catholic thing.
Mm-hmm.
So that was at least, you know, something I can talk about that isn't just the same thing that a lot of atheists talk about the same exact stuff, as I'm sure you guys have experienced, without anything new to say. Skepticism I came into that later, through, I guess, sort of my friends and different things. And then came across online, probably not until like four years ago. I got into that, and then eventually, you know, just read up on the history of that, realized, you know, that some of it tied in well to what I do as a teacher, which is argumentation, rhetoric, communication, and could tie, you know, the toolkit of scientific skepticism into that. And then gave a talk at Denver Skeptic Camp in 2012, and then ended up getting to be at TAM that year and ever since. So got into that in that way. I suppose really not anything to do with my atheism, but just maybe some different focus. And I really loved, you know, that topic of the intersection of those two. I realized that it's kind of hard to make it interesting in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
But also, I think the basic thing we can say about it is that, you know, we all, whatever our causes or our interests is or our passion is within, you know, our atheism, skepticism, et cetera, we want to communicate it well, so that it gets out there, whatever our audience is. So yeah. We want to use the right tools. We want to have the right, we want to, you know, reach the right audience. We want to persuade or inform in the most effective way and be clear and things like that. And so that we can, so that's going to be an important, you know, tool for any of us, no matter what our specific niches are, our interests. And then just realizing we can apply that to skepticism as it applies to critical thinking too, you know, and importance of teaching critical thinking skills, or, you know, modeling that, the importance of encouraging people to question everything, to question their own beliefs, especially to use evidence, you know, to support their assertions with evidence, all that basic stuff. It sounds, you know, it is basic, but I think a lot of people don't think about it necessarily. And, that it's a way to, I suppose there's a lot of people in skepticism, specifically scientific skepticism, as it's usually referred to, that, you know, do the direct work of it. That's not the right term, but, and then there's those of us who, you know, focus on communicating it and how to best do that. So yeah, that's essentially what I got into. Not really tied into atheism, but I got tired of sort of, I suppose, writing about atheism and stuff like, and I think it's easy to get burned out on atheism.
It's easy to get burned out on just about anything.
Exactly.
If your focus is how the Catholic Church is bad, there's only so many things you can say about
That's true. Exactly. It's easy.
They're always coming up with new writing material.
Well, exactly. Yeah. There is, I suppose, a thing of don't want to be repetitive. So I think a way to fix that is just, yeah, I don't go on and on about it. I have to be careful about that, but also just to focus on certain aspects of it. I mean, yeah, if you were someone who wanted to, you could constantly document the awfulness of the church for sure. I really dislike Pope Francis. So I have written a few things about him, and people don't like that so much. A lot of people really dig Pope Francis, which is really weird.
He
Pope
is shockingly popular.
He is
shockingly popular, and the fucker doesn't say a damn thing.
Oh, I know. It's just, to me, it's all rhetoric in the bad sense, empty rhetoric, because if you look at his track record when he was Cardinal
Berlusconi?
Something like that, yeah. He had a horrible track record the things he claims now, you know, well, as you said, he doesn't really say anything. It's just platitudes, essentially. Like, his Twitter is hilarious. You know, it's like, pray for peace. Let us love each other. You know, so it's like, okay. He constantly talks about wealth redistribution, you know, so it's like he comes off as this Marxist or something to people, I think. But he obviously, you know, he lives in the Vatican. He runs one of the most wealthy organizations in the world. Mm-hmm. So, it's, you know, obviously there's that. Everybody knows that. And, you know, it's become a joke. But so his words don't mean anything. Plus, I think he's full of it. I think he's the worst pope I've lived through, which is saying something. I mean, John Paul and Benedict are the only other ones. I actually think Francis is the worst because he's a wolf in sheep's clothing. Whereas the other guys were just, you know, just pretty much more direct about who they were. I mean, John Paul was like, well, no one liked Benedict, understandably, because he's like Palpatine.
But yeah, they backed up their words with actions.
Right. They just
John Paul was nice outwardly, but he had some really bad child abuse policies.
Oh, he's a bad dude.
Ratzenberger, you know, he was just never a nice guy anyways. But Pope Frank, yeah, that dude, okay, fine. So he's not wearing the Versace red slippers, right. And he got rid of the big chair. But, you know, he's talking about wealth redistribution. Let's fucking see it.
I know, exactly.
Sell off some of that gold they have.
Well, the Vatican is just, And then he was the cardinal in Argentina for a long time. And he directly, you know, one of the easiest ways to help poverty on a large scale is to allow for family planning and just for women to not have to have 12 children and, you know, in poor countries and things like that. Well, he actively worked against the distribution of birth control and condoms specifically, which also means that, you know, there's less protection against AIDS and sexually transmitted diseases. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he actively stopped those things, campaigned to stop those things from happening in Argentina. So again, that's going against, you know, helping poverty and things like that. So his actions, many of his actions don't stand up to that at all. Yeah. And then, you know, as people have pointed out, no matter what he says and how huggable people think he is or whatever, it doesn't matter. It doesn't affect the doctrine. I mean, you know, like he says, oh, I'm going to ask the Catholics what they think. Let's have these phone conversations. But the synod is coming up of the bishops, and basically as soon as he said that, the bishops or somebody put out a statement that was like, okay, no matter what Francis says, it doesn't affect it. You know, doctrine is doctrine. We're just going to have our synod. He can, you know, so it doesn't, he's affirmed the doctrine constantly, you know, on, just because he hugged a gay guy or whatever, you know, as long as you don't have sex, you know, and be gay, essentially.
Well, yeah. And he said that, you know, talk about it less while at the same time continuing all the same exact policies.
And also excommunicated a couple gay Catholic clergy.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. And I mean, and these things are in the news. You know, it's not like they're total secret, but yet so many people like him. That's what it's just fascinating to me. It's frustrating, especially when atheists like him and seem to think he's just cool. And I don't know. He's actually dreadfully boring. When I had not watched him really give a full sermon until I watched the canonization of the live stream of it recently of John Paul and Cut John the Second or whatever, who did I think he was canonized sort of as a token gift to the more progressive, shall we say, wing of the Catholic Church, because he's the one who convened Vatican II. Which none of us would consider progressive, really, but it sort of brought the church into slightly the 20th century.
Is that before or after John Paul's statue killed that guy?
You mean when Vatican II? or
statue was like 2 days before canonization.
That was hilarious because of John Paul has committed, has at least performed two verified quote unquote miracles, he couldn't stop that statue from killing this guy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's logic.
I just think that should take away one of his miracles. That I can...
Yeah, I had not heard the full story of his second verified miracle until recently, but a lady in, I can't remember, somewhere in Central America, she had apparently an aneurysm in her brain. Apparently the doctor sent her home and said, you're going to die. We can't do anything. So she got there, she got home, and it was the fifth anniversary of John Paul's death. So he was in the newspaper, a picture of him. So the picture started talking to her, apparently. She says in the newspaper and looking at her, and he talked to her, and her brain aneurysm was thus healed. Joan John Paul's picture talked to her and looked at her. So that's his second verified miracle. As people have pointed out that know this stuff, I don't know how to explain it. You know, it's not my field, but obviously, but whatever she had, that type of aneurysm often does, you know, go away. So,
yeah, but, I think an article I saw said something like 50% of cases.
Right. And it was a newspaper picture. That's what's pathetic. You know, it's not even, he didn't like come to her in the night or something, his spirit. It'd be so weird. I mean, it's surreal to me to think, well, wow, a newspaper picture talked to me. I mean, I can't imagine not feeling just like dreadful shame at being so embarrassed at that. Like, yeah, guys, the newspaper picture totally talked to me and looked at me. And now I'm healed. But that's his second verified miracle.
It's better than him coming to her in the night.
Well, that's true. But at least, like, if you saw the spirit of... I mean, it's all hallucination anyway. I mean, no one seems to bring up the fact that she had some brain issues that obviously may lead to hallucination.
Yeah.
A newspaper talking to you. Like, hallucinogenic drugs, probably a similar effect.
We can't stop here. This is backcountry.
Yeah, exactly. So a little bit druggy, but John II was also canonized recently. He's the one who called Vatican II. He convened Vatican II, and then he sort of was like, peace out, and dropped dead. But so he's sort of not loved in the Catholic Church among the conservatives. Anyway, I had not heard Francis talk until the canonization, which I watched part of the live stream of. It was so boring. I mean, part of it was I usually like listening to Latin because I can understand a bit of it, and it's just sort of soothing. But he made it really boring. And his sermon he read, actually, which kind of surprised me.
Mm.
You know, I mean, it's impressive that the popes can speak a bunch of languages, but still. I was like, this guy is, wow, he's really not charismatic, you know.
Well, his first language is Spanish.
Yeah.
And then I'm guessing he hitchingly learned Latin.
He seems pretty fluent and Italian, and then he's okay. I think he knows some English. He definitely is fluent in Italian.
No, his parents were Italian.
Yeah, for sure. That's why his name is Bergoglio. Yeah, it's definitely an Italian name. He does Latin, it just, you know, fine, but it was very boring to see. There's really no charisma there, except for people think so because he goes out and he smiles and he hugs the babies and the, you know, he was a bouncer or whatever. So people think that was really cool. I don't know. He had a motorcycle. So people are really depressingly willing to let the defense of these horrible bullshit policies stand because he's avuncular and jolly chap or whatever. It's like, wow, okay. I don't buy that. And so I think, as you said, he just, his Twitter is hilarious. I mean, because I think it's the ultimate sort of encapsulation of the bullshit, just the nothingness that he speaks. Like, okay, let's pray for peace. All right. we've all seen that, I think, as I've been surprised as to see atheists being like, oh, he's so cool. And people thinking the church is going to change. It's not going to change. No, it's just not. Little changes happen when it's dragged into the 21st century, but
kicking and screaming.
Yeah. Kicking and screaming, exactly. Especially about like Vatican II, it was barely masses in English now, and there's girl altar servers and things like that. But you know,
that's the biggest change I ever heard about coming from Vatican II is Mass in English.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I'm pretty sure there was Mass in English before
that. The worst mistake they could ever done.
Latin Mass is actually really soothing. You know, I can pick up some of it, but it's mostly just like melodic to me. So I enjoy that. But yeah, it's Vatican II wasn't even that big of a deal, but you know, the conservative wing of the Catholic Church hate it big time. And so yeah, the church isn't going to change. The Pope isn't going to, he doesn't want to change. He isn't going to get up and speak ex cathedra you know, I think some people think the Pope is always infallible. I think a lot of people think that, you know, and he's not always infallible. It's only when he chooses to speak ex cathedra, which is means from the chair. and that just doesn't happen frequently. I don't know if he has to get in the chair when he's infallible, if they can just say, I'm in the chair. But he's, you know, a lot of people think he's always infallible, which is interesting.
There's some fun discussion with that when they started the Twitter account. As to whether or not the tweets would be infallible.
And there's no way that dude tweets himself, you know. I mean, well, maybe, you know, I think, well, he obviously dictates his tweets, but when Benedict was the first tweeter at that account. Mm-hmm. And there's a picture of him on an iPad tweeting, because he tweeted out his one tweet himself, and then he would dictate it. As someone pointed out, the tweets started coming from TweetDeck after that. So, and they said, you know, he was dictating his tweets, but so everybody's kind of picturing Benedict with TweetDeck, like, what are Benedict's columns? You know, evil center or something. So anyway, yeah, that's a good point about the Twitter thing. I think a lot of people think that he's always infallible, which is interesting because that would really be weird. And depressing. Also, I can't remember what it's called, but John Paul, another one of the shady things John Paul did was, he introduced something where the cardinals who are up for Pope election during the conclaves, have to basically sign this thing that they're not really going to change church doctrine. So that sort of prevents certain things, you know, cause John Paul was a traditionalist, definitely. St. John Paul, I should say, or I guess probably has a saint name now. I haven't even looked that up. Yeah, I don't know.
Miranda, could you give us a little preview of what your TAM 2014 presentation is going to be on?
Absolutely. We haven't figured it out completely yet, but my TAM workshop will be called Rhetoric and Argumentation for the Skeptic. Last year, I was involved in one that was similar, but it was focused on in education and in the classroom. So this will be more, I'm sure we'll have some of that because the two people I've gotten to be in my workshop so far are also teachers.
Nice.
So I'm trying to find a non-teacher or two, hopefully, so we can be more diverse. But so we're going to talk about this kind of the stuff I mentioned earlier about how we can apply rhetoric and argumentation most effectively when we want to persuade people, or depending on who we want to persuade, you know, are we talking to the fence sitters or the people who don't, you know, aren't familiar with these topics, or are we trying to educate? Are we trying to, you know, what's our tactic? Is it more rational argumentation, or is it ethical to appeal to emotions? When does ridicule work if one wants to use it? Who does that reach? Not that necessarily we'll cover all these topics, but that's the general idea. Just rhetoric and persuasion. And, you know, there are, what's great is there's a lot of quantitative studies out there of basically what has, you know, it's impossible to say 100% of the time, but what often works when persuading people or informing people. And so we'll focus on that and we'll make it as interesting as possible. I think it's an interesting topic, one that's relevant to skepticism, definitely, and one that can be, I mean, everybody ends up trying to persuade somebody of something, let's say, even if they're not involved in skeptical activism or whatever activism or whatever we do.
All right.
So, yeah. Then
what would be a couple quick ideas that you could use on somebody that doesn't really agree with you or see your point of view?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say, you know, in that situation, it'd be very bad idea to be uncivil or to get angry or to ridicule. And I think that's the mistake I see a lot of people make, you know, when they, you know, they'll be dickish, let's say, or just make fun of the people. I mean, I think that can probably work on fence sitters and friends and things like that, you know, because it sort of is a preaching to the crowd. But for that, I think one is probably best, the approach that's best for that is to try to come to sort of a common understanding, to actually, you know, to not treat the person like an idiot, to try to emphasize, you know, the importance of what we're talking about, maybe the information. And I'm not, I don't necessarily focus so much on like debate, but more like just persuasive speech, persuasive, you know, in whatever context. So basically, don't be uncivil, inform as much as possible, you know, don't assume the person is stupid. Those are important things always. And try to, you know, emphasize that this is important for, you know, you to understand for the following reasons. It's not just because, you know, I feel strongly about it, but it has a relevance to your life. You know, here's why, let's say, critical thinking or questioning this topic is important, because it can be, there are a lot of things where, like, you know, anti-vaxxers, things like that, you know, it's very dangerous. So it would be, you know, it's hard to talk to or persuade someone like that. But, you know, you can, here's the reasons why. And I do think respecting the audience, and, you know, even if we really have a hard time doing that because we feel like, God, how could they not get this? Or why are they so tense or something? I think that is a very effective manner of discussion and persuasion. Just not being an asshole.
Instead of you're a fucking idiot.
Right.
Go more with, or you're a fucking child killer. With something along the lines of, you know, if you don't vaccinate your children, they are at increased risk of getting these diseases and dying.
Yeah. And yeah, I guess the one thing is at the same time, though, we don't, just using information, you know, it can be really boring too, I think, for people, because sometimes information, they don't care either. So, but like you said, though, it's important. There's an element of emotional appeal in there too, which is good. You know, no one wants their kid to die.
That's something I was wondering about also.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of these people that have non-scientific thoughts or approaches to things come at things at an emotional level. A lot like religious people do. Exactly. So do you think it's more important to hit them with an emotional appeal than it is to hit them with facts as often?
Yeah, I think it depends. I don't think just throwing facts out there is ever effective, just because they probably know the facts. I mean, not everyone, but, you know, a lot of times people know the facts and just don't care.
And then there's people who just don't believe the facts.
That's true. Exactly. There's denial, you know, deniers. So they either don't believe it, or especially conspiracy theorists, if the topic is on that, you know, path, or they know and they don't care. They don't believe. So, and they probably have heard it. So it's not like generally we tell them a fact and they're just going to be like, oh, I see the light. So I think there is a certain amount of emotional appeal there, but at the same time, we got to be careful with that too, and not be like, who will think of the children or something. You know, you don't want to go hell and love joy on them or something, because that gets cliche. So, you know, classic rhetoric, we have logos, pathos, ethos. So I think sometimes logos is a logical, rational appeal, pathos is emotional appeal, and ethos is appeal to sort of tone and how, you know, ethics, our own ethics. And I think in ethos in that sense is important when we're talking to people who believe on an emotional level. We can also use emotional appeal, but I think it's important to not be manipulative, especially if people are in a fragile state. The word isn't fragile, but, you know, delusional state. Not that delusional sounds better, but yeah, there's not a lot of people's beliefs are not based in fact, and they don't want them to be. So, you know, sometimes we have to realize we're not always going to be successful too, but just be informative, be as persuasive, use emotion when it's I think ethical to do so. I guess basically don't manipulate. Ask people questions. You know, I think that's important. And if you're doing one-on-one stuff too, and respect, I think always respecting the audience is a good thing, and assuming knowledge on your audience isn't an idiot and things like that. Mm-hmm. You know, it's easier to, I mean, we'll go into detail with different examples of that for sure, but it's, you know, that's, and I should say, like, something like anti-vaxxers is the extreme level of that, you know, where people that, there are issues where denying is actually leading to deaths and, you know, horrible things like that. And then there's, you know, issues that aren't quite as dire.
Like, so, ghosts.
Ghosts, yeah. I mean, I think those things are good in a sense of teaching critical thinking skills to people, though, of like how to question, you know, like, you know, Bigfoot is cheesy and stuff, but I do see that, I understand why people do bring that stuff up, because it's, in skepticism, it's something you can teach critical thinking and questioning about, because people don't have a general, you know, when we do that with religion, it can be tricky. I think we should do it with religion too, but because people have an emotional tie to their religion usually, but not to Bigfoot. You know, I'm sure there are
people. Some do.
Yeah. We care about, you know, when you're religious, you're defensive sometimes often about it.
Yeah. A Bigfoot hunting group posted to one of the local atheist groups here about a camping trip and Bigfoot search they're going to be doing.
Yeah.
They got a lot of shit for that.
Yeah. It's interesting. The Pacific Northwest is like Bigfoot Central. I was convinced he lived in Washington when I was a kid. I think because of Harry and the Hendersons, maybe, or that movie. Yeah. But yeah, well, that's, you know, that brings up a point too, that not all atheists are skeptics, unfortunately. I mean, just using the skeptic as the term critical, you know, to mean critical thinking, even, got a lot of atheists who are into astrology and all that, but that's a whole nother topic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, not all atheists are skeptics, and not all skeptics are atheists.
That's a good point. So, you know, and I can see why that frustrates a lot of people, but at the same time, you know, I think we have to focus on the things that are actually affecting other people. I know people that really just want to, I don't enjoy debate for debate's sake myself. I know there's a lot of people that do, especially online. I think most of us would go crazy if we don't focus on, you know, what's most important to us and what we care, what's most important to us, in a utilitarian sense, and to inform and educate and persuade about. And all this can, you know, when we apply it, it's a lot more interesting than it sounds, I think, because we all do what we can and what we're interested in and what we like to do. It shouldn't be an obligation necessarily, even though I think we all feel a certain, those of us that are involved in, you know, skepticism or atheism, I think we feel a certain pull to it because we think it's important, obviously, in some level, to certain degrees. We take it more lighthearted, or we take it not so lighthearted, but yeah, the Bigfoot people. But I think that stuff, I mean, it's cheesy, but it's an example of something people generally don't have an emotional tie to. So you can kind of, they can question it easier. But I'm sure there are Bigfoot lovers out there that are, you know, religious and about Bigfoot, or love Bigfoot big time. Who knows? I'm sure there's a whole, maybe there's Bigfoot fetish. I don't know. There could be. There always is, right? Rule 34 or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, and too bad Wesley's offline for that one.
Oh, I was like, what happened to him? He's a little box. Yeah, exactly. So maybe there's Bigfoot fetishes. Who knows? But there's some. I think that's obviously a less fraught topic than religion. Wesley missed the Rule 34.
Oh, I know Rule 34.
No, I mean, I was saying maybe there's a, who knows, there's probably Bigfoot fetishes out there. But so maybe there are people that have ties to.
Really? Give me 10 seconds.
No, I know what you mean. That's the thing. Yeah, I'm sure there's Bigfoot lovers. So there are people with ties to it, but it's not like religion. So now I'm picturing the Church of Religion the Church of Bigfoot combined with Bigfoot fetishes. That'd be a funny church. That's the kind of thing that makes me wish I could like animate things and make cartoons.
Yeah, yeah. Sure, the church on the front side and the
Bigfoot strip club, or sure,
fetish club in the back.
Somehow tied into the furries.
Furries, yeah. Really tall furries.
I have to share this image. It's,
you found it already? That's awesome. I see it. It's the internet for you.
That's okay.
Man, furries are weird too.
And hey, Wesley, you're a little quiet now.
Okay.
It's because he's okay. Let me see that. Oh my god, that's hilarious.
Wow.
So that's hilarious. It's basically the Tarzan, essentially. Tarzanish.
All I did was Google image search Bigfoot porn, and that was awesome. The first picture that came up, but it gets much worse from there.
Well, I'm going to have to look that up later, of course.
Anyway,
that's interesting. I'm sure, you know, at a different kind of skeptics conference, we could have a Bigfoot porn discussion. I guess I never thought of that, but that's interesting. I'm sure there's ghost. Well, we know there's ghost porn because that's in the news, or there's been ghost sex in the news or whatever.
That's a big thing lately.
Yeah, like people, ladies are saying they have sex with ghosts, and it's really good sex, apparently.
When it's all in your imagination, it can be as great as you want.
Like, well, I can't imagine it being that good without any corporeal form, but I guess
throw in the Hitachi magic wand and there you have it.
That's true, but they don't do that really.
I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that Mary was the first ghost sex.
That could be. That's a good point.
Yeah.
God, the Holy Spirit.
Yeah.
Came to her in the night.
Came in her in the night.
Yeah, well, actually, that's related to a picture I found yesterday of an old vintage Christian album I put on Twitter. But it's a gospel trio of ladies, singers from the 60s, I think, called The Sound of His Coming.
Oh.
And the cover is these ladies, these little, not old ladies necessarily, but 50s or something. And they just look so, yeah. The Sound of His Coming. There's a lot of that kind of thing where I don't know if they don't realize it or they, yeah. But yeah, Mary had some ghost sex and she got knocked up. So,
mm-hmm.
So that was interesting. That's been in the news. I don't get it, but hey. apparently ghosts are good lovers or something.
Very considerate. Even though they can't move, they're very considerate lovers.
Yes. That would actually be interesting. I'm sure there are people who like debunk it. That'd be kind of a funny thing to debunk. If you interviewed someone who you'd have to not laugh and that'd be hard. So you had sex with a ghost last night. How's that for you? Oh God.
Oh wow.
I guess was it Saint Teresa who had sex with God or what? Or she? Oh, she describes this. I don't know if it's Saint Teresa, but she describes this orgiastic experience she had with the Holy Spirit. I mean, it's not. She doesn't talk about sex because it's a very long time ago. But when we read it now, it's like, whoa, lady. So, you know, sometimes these nuns and people have their experiences. Let's say. With spirits and if you never had sex, I suppose you know you might think that is sex. Who knows? But
yeah,
you guys have to do a whole episode on like Bigfoot porn now. I'm sure there's like someone who gets an expert.
I'm down.
You probably would. I mean, yeah, call up like the site owner. So you want to be on my show? We yeah. Tell me about your photo shoots with the lady.
Yeah, we could take on Be Reasonable and put out our own version.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Be creepy.
But hey, they have, I guess you got to stand out in, online and even in the sex porn naked pictures market. So, hey, it's more interesting than furries, I guess, or less pathetic, more funny. Not Care Bears, you know, at least. There's a little.
I wonder if there's a real life pony porn. Not bestiality, I'm saying.
Oh, probably.
Furry pony
porn. Oh, there's everything. Yeah. Actually, there's a list on Wikipedia that's pretty hilarious of paraphilias that people are into. That is one of my favorite Wikipedia pages. There's one that's nasophilia, which is the nose. So people that like to penetrate the nose. I don't even want to think about how that works.
There's also people who get off on sneezing.
Oh, that's right. I've heard that one. I mean, I guess that makes more sense because for women, it can be tied into certain things.
It was a woman who got off on other people sneezing.
Oh, okay. That doesn't
on her?
Not necessarily on her, but just being around sneezing. And it would make her quite aroused.
Yeah.
And for porn, we just watch sneezing videos.
Right. That is a hell of a convulsion.
Well, being a psychologist and analyzing such people would be fascinating, really. I mean, like, where do you start to get an interest sexually in sneezing?
Go to Japan and watch all the teens lick each other's eyeballs.
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, there's some weird shit. I mean, And we have, there's some stuff that I suppose is just not any weirder than what most people do. It's just out of our, you know, norm. But then there's some stuff where it just makes no sense. Or you wonder the logistics of nose penetration. I mean, oh my gosh. I guess we don't know if people actually carry out their interests, but it has a Wikipedia page.
Micropenises?
It has to be. I don't know how one could survive that, but yeah, other than different things, I don't know. I guess it's not, and I'm not curious enough to really look it up, like look up the more non-Wikipedia details. But it's one of the, it's the one that stood out to me as like, whoa, that's not something you could do that often.
Without, yeah,
without self harm, let's say, or how we put it. Hey,
although it could cause some sneezing.
Oh yeah, hey, get the sneezing lady in there. Well, the thing is, it's interesting that the sneezing lady went public. I guess she probably didn't use her name, but when people talk about that stuff like publicly, I'm like, oh dear.
Actually, I'm remembering more details. It was a Savage Love cast. It was somebody worried that her daughter had a sneezing fetish.
Did her daughter tell her?
No, it was. Okay, I think there's both been somebody who called talking about it, and somebody who called with a daughter who just saw everything she watched on YouTube was sneezing.
Gotcha. So she thought,
it's like, why isn't there just some regular porn here? Come on.
My kid doesn't. I mean, she surely knows how to find porn, yet she just looks at sneezing. That's hilarious. I guess that would be a Dan Savage show type of question. interesting. I was thinking maybe she came to her mom and was like, Mom, when people sneeze, I find it so interesting. Yeah. I always wonder, life must be way more, I mean, negotiating relationships and personal situations, let's say, and stuff is hard enough, you know, for people that don't have extreme fetishes. Mm-hmm. So I always wonder, like, man, life must be, you know, more complicated. In that sense, for people that have very specific interests, let's say. Look up the list of paraphilias. It's quite amusing. I don't know if people actually do these things or not, but maybe they're just interested. But there's psychologists that study them, so they have Wikipedia pages about them. But I'm sure that's a very classy topic for me to bring up on your show. The nasophilia.
It's par for the course, actually.
Maybe there's some debunking of nasophilia or something. Critical thinking. No one, I mean, it's like me. There's a lot of stuff where I'm like, oh, I got to totally look that up and see what's online. But I don't know. I don't want to see nasophilia if it is a real thing. That sounds like it would traumatize, you know, and not be.
But there are people that have fetishes and paraphilias that are non-realizable.
Oh, sure.
Which just ends up being incredibly frustrating.
Oh, the giant thing. Yeah. Or being smushed by a giant woman. That would be weird, yeah. I suppose if you're into... and it's hard because it's not like when people are into God or ghosts and they think they have sex with God and ghosts, because people know they're not being smushed by a giantess.
Mm-hmm. and they know they don't have any centaurs to to summon.
It'd be so weird. I do wonder how those interests develop, you know?
Would that be where you put like a Nixon mask onto a horse?
That would be funny.
Instead of, you know, the horse head onto a guy.
Yeah. That would be good. You're right. If it's impossible, that would be very frustrating. And I guess your whole life you'd be like, God, I just have to have regular human sex.
What is that?
I don't know. That's an interesting thing. And I guess just it is fascinating to know where the hell a person would start to be interested in some of the things they are, but I guess maybe it relates to something in their childhood.
Often, yeah.
I don't know where the nose would come from, but hey. Maybe they just really liked the look of them.
Yeah.
Somebody doing, I got your nose just one time.
Exactly. Well, hey, that was fun. It's interesting. The internet teaches us many things about critical thinking and about porn.
Porn and cats.
And cats. Yes, that's what it's good for.
All right. We are starting to run out of time.
We are.
Yeah, I suppose.
You got anything else you want to cover?
No, it's just I appreciate you guys having me on to talk about this stuff. And I I'll post some more information about my TAM workshop as soon as, you know, I get it, the description written up, and, you know, my friends and I that are doing it start to figure out what we're going to do. I'll put some more information on that, about that on my website.
Sweet.
Awesome.
That is just that. And hopefully I'll be maybe doing some skeptic stuff in other contexts, and who knows.
And the link to your website will be in the show notes.
Yep. And paraphilia list from Wikipedia. No, I'm just kidding.
Hell yeah.
That's important.
I'll add it now.
Oh, God.
Listing. Heck, is vanilla sex is boring.
Oh, God. It's going to be so many quotes from Miranda. Yeah, that's interesting. Wikipedia provides, you know. And it ties to skepticism, I'm sure. But hey, it's more—it's really more fun to look up the paraphilia.
I wonder if Susan and the rest of the gorilla
skeptics
helped edit those pages.
That'd be funny. They're funny.
Oh, man.
She's intense.
She was a fun interview, too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I bet. She's intense and she talks. She's a cool lady, though.
All righty.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Definitely. And
yeah, thank you.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Atheist Nomads. You can find us online at www.atheistnomads.com. Contact us at contact@atheistnomads.com or leave us a voicemail message at 541-203-0666. You can also like us on Facebook or leave us a review on iTunes, Zoom, or wherever else you find the podcast. Until next time, this has been the Atheist Nomads.
God, why am I still looking at Bigfoot porn? okay, close that.
For those of you listening, that will make more sense after you hear the interview.
This day in history, 1756. This day in history, 17... God damn it. This day in history, May 15th, 1756, the Seven Wars... This day in history, May 15, 1756, the Seven Years' War begins.
Pale Western. Skin and Western wiles.
Your wily Western ways.
I also kind of sound like a guy today because of my allergies, but yeah, Catholicism is a bitch.
Yeah, awesome. Hey, not too shabby today.
Yeah, we've
not
only been recording for 4 hours.
Yeah, hey, what could go wrong?